WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Republican convention ended last night, and so all those media people are packing up and heading our way. So are some of the few protesters that were there. And, of course, we're about to be descended on by thousands of Democratic Party delegates. Are we ready? We look at that later in the program, and we'll get an historical overview of political conventions in America since they began in 1831. First, though, a real example of Charlotte's preparedness for this convention. Hopefully, everything will go smoothly. But if a delegate gets sick, if a protester breaks a leg, if one of those TV journalists gets a hair out of place, Carolina's Medical Center has set up what is essentially another hospital. CMC is rolling out Med One, their mobile hospital. It's been to the scene of many emergencies and can handle almost any medical situation. Dr. David Calloway, MD, is the medical director of Med One, the Carolina's healthcare system's mobile emergency department, and has played a key role in the health and medical planning for the upcoming convention. Welcome.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate being here.
How many times has this unit, this big self-sustained hospital essentially, been deployed?
Yeah, Carolina's Med One was this first in its kind of mobile hospital, and it first deployed to Katrina in 2005 and subsequently had two more disaster deployments in the next few years. It's deployed out to Arizona last year to support the renovation of a hospital and provide a freestanding emergency department so that they didn't have to close their facilities. And then we do a number of daily, one-day community outreach events where we support healthcare outreach and nonprofits providing care in our local community.
How unique is this unit? In other words, how many hospitals around the country or hospital systems around the country have something like this?
It's exceptionally unique. There's only one other Carolina. There's one other Med One in existence. It's in a warehouse out in Los Angeles. It's very unique for a private system to have a mobile hospital like Carolina's Med One, and especially one that's driving innovation on the healthcare side and on the energy and the technology side like we do.
Why do we have it?
It's a great question. It was after 9/11, there was some effort by a local emergency medicine physician, and then the Carolina's Medical Center Emergency Department, supported by Carolina's healthcare system, to drive this desire to create local resilience. And essentially, the thought was, as federal dollars wane and they wax and wane, we can't always rely on outside help. So we need to have this capability locally. Mm-hmm. And in addition to providing local support, we can also then be a regional asset. And we had some pretty good visionaries about a decade ago who pushed for this Med One.
Now, we have a significant number of relatively large and well-equipped hospitals in the immediate vicinity of downtown Charlotte. Why did Carolina's healthcare system feel the need to roll out Med One for the DNC?
That's a great question. We looked back at the different national special security events, so these conventions that have happened in Boston, Denver, Chicago, Minneapolis, and what we found was we have two core missions as a healthcare system. One is to continue to provide care for our community, and the other is to provide care specific to this complex event that mm-hmm. is the convention. And so the goal was to put an advanced treatment facility in Uptown in order to provide care for people so that they can get rapid care and return to the convention, which is a major national event for them, but also to offset some of the additional volume that may go to our emergency department so that they can continue to focus on providing care for our Charlottesians.
So if you've got the emergency room at Carolina's Medical Center up and running and you've got this up and running, where does the extra medical personnel come from for this?
So we always have additional staff. As you can imagine, any hospital has additional staff, and they work in shifts so that they can provide care 24/7 and have backup care. Mm-hmm. We have a dedicated team that has come from the entire Carolina's healthcare system. The original Med One team was just from Carolina's Medical Center, Maine. Okay. We've expanded that, so now we draw ICU nurses, emergency medicine nurses from the entire 30-plus hospital network of Carolina's healthcare system into this mobile hospital, actually. It's more than an emergency department, to provide this care. So we're fully staffed in the emergency departments at each facility. Presbyterian is fully staffed, and this is an additional asset that is there in the case of emergency, but also just to provide good top-tier care for our visitors.
Describe this piece of equipment, this unit. Is it more than a tractor trailer? What is it?
Absolutely. So if you imagine walking into an emergency department, modern emergency department, with cardiac monitors, air condition, electronic medical records. Now add two operating rooms, four ICU beds, put it on wheels, make it mobile, and add on a team of dynamic, highly trained emergency medicine practitioners with an eye towards innovation, and that's Med One.
Would the operating rooms be used in this? I mean, I understand why they would be used in Katrina, where there were the hospitals didn't have any power, and this is a self-sustained unit. But here, if somebody really does need surgery, they have an appendix that needs to be removed. Are they going to go there, or are they going to go to the main hospital?
They'll go to the main hospital. In this case, we've refurbished our operating room to serve as a resuscitation bay, so we can provide additional care if somebody happens to be extremely sick and they come into Med One because we're the closest facility. Mm-hmm. But anybody who has an elective procedure or a condition that is easily stabilized, they'll go to the fixed facility, the hospitals, yeah, and they'll get their care there. Med One is mostly going to provide emergency care, but then also if there happens to be an event, whether it's a tornado or hurricane or some intentional act of violence, Med One will be there to provide augmented ability to provide advanced care.
Where will you be located?
We'll be in the uptown area.
That's it, huh? No more specific than that. How will we find you if we need you?
There'll be a large tree of life, and actually you'll probably see a large reflective panel, which is the solar panel that'll be powering some of our ancillary devices.
The tree of life is the logo.
The tree of life is the Carolinas Healthcare System logo.
Now, seriously, I'm laughing about this because we are being told virtually nothing about virtually everything, including where we're going to park on Monday. So where will you be located? You're not allowed to tell us? Seriously?
Well, it'll be within the area that's designed for the delegates. You'll know as of tomorrow. It'll be quite apparent where we'll okay. be, but it'll be in the uptown area, and it'll be designed to provide care specifically for the people visiting the convention.
So this is another example of where loose lips sink ships, and your lips have been sealed because you're working in conjunction, I would presume, with the Secret Service and many other law enforcement agencies to keep a wrap on this. How do you tell your employees where to go, and how do you keep them quiet? I'm serious.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we rely heavily on the professionalism of our team, to be honest. They trust that we're going to get them to where they need to be, and our team has been briefed up on where they'll need to be, where they'll be operating, what their hours are, and honestly, there will be a very clear sort of communication once this convention kicks off about where all the different assets are.
So if somebody has a problem, and maybe an ambulance is called or emergency professionals are called to the scene, who makes the decision about whether or not that patient needs to see your facility or needs to go to one of the other hospitals in town? Who makes that decision?
There's a medical control system in place, and essentially it's operations as usual. I mean, Charlotte has a very tried and tested emergency response system. And so there are protocols in place for who goes to which type of hospital, and that's the Mecklenburg EMS agency. Within the facilities, there's going to be a judgment call. There are two or three physicians that have been designated as the medical directors for different areas, mm-hmm. And they'll work in concert to determine who needs to go where. But our EMS personnel are extremely professional, and they're able to look at somebody and say, hey, this is somebody who's got a sprained ankle, they need an x-ray, they can go back to the convention, or this is somebody who's really sick and needs to go to one of our other fixed hospitals.
Okay. Dr. David Calloway is our guest. He's the medical director of Med One, the Carolinas Healthcare System's mobile emergency department. You served for 3 years, I think, as an expeditionary physician supporting the U.S. Marine Corps. You then trained at the Harvard University Affiliated Emergency Medicine Residency. You were also selected this year by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader due to your innovative work in disaster, humanitarian, and crisis medical response. Is this a new and emerging field of medicine?
It's been around since there's been crisis, but in the last decade or so, there's been a large move to professionalize disaster response and how we respond to crisis events. And especially with the rapidly evolving technology, when we talk about how do we respond to an event like Haiti or how do we provide medical care in the hills of Afghanistan, it becomes more than just the medical care provided. It's how do we get the logistics in place? How do we get the communications in place? And in our case, again, how do we fuel and power an advanced medical treatment facility?
So in addition to being a medical doctor, you have to think about a lot of other things, the logistics. Your mind thinks in a lot of other ways other than just medicine. When did you know this about yourself?
I knew this about myself when I left my internship in 2002 and arrived on the Marine Corps base in Hawaii and was told by my commanding officer I had 5 months to prepare us to go to war. And I was about 6 months out of 1 year of advanced medical training, and that process started my interest in how do we prepare to provide medical care in austere or difficult environments? How do we take threat and distance into account? And how do we really get there and still provide the same level of care no matter where we are?
It also strikes me that the field of medicine that you're in must be highly stressful because you're having to work under extreme conditions with an extreme amount of unpredictability, lots of patients in some cases that are coming to you with unknown problems quickly that need to be handled and triaged, et cetera. Do you thrive on the adrenaline rush or the stress? I mean, what is it? Do you worry about this? You're a young guy, but you won't be for long if you keep this up.
Well, it depends who you ask, if you ask my wife or if you ask my friends. But you have to have a certain comfort with ambiguity and with chaos. And in emergency medicine, we never know what's coming in the emergency department anyways. But in my particular case, I tend to thrive in environments where we're not sure what the next challenge is going to be. And I can find that you partner with unique people in these situations, and adversity really drives innovation. And it's great to see the kind of solutions that your colleagues come up with when they have no other options.
Well, that brings us to a point about Med One, because this is kind of an innovative vehicle. It's not just a hospital on wheels that can go different places. It is a self-sustained unit. And by that, you mean you've partnered with a lot of different entities other than medical entities to make this state-of-the-art cutting edge.
Absolutely. And Med One's origins were innovative, but over the last year or so, we partnered with local energy leaders, Lime Energy and So Energy, and gotten some help from CLT Jules, which is a energy innovator, to come up with what we call the Med One Green Project. And we hope that this is really going to redefine the future of mobile medicine by creating a completely off-grid medical response capability.
Meaning, how do you supply your power? Where is it come from? Generators? Does it come from the sun? What does it come from?
Exactly. So right now we have 200 kilowatt generators that are diesel fueled. Mm-hmm. So if we were to respond to Isaac like we did to Katrina, we would fill up our trucks, we would drive down there, we would set up our generators and be fueled by diesel fuel. We know that the power grid is out. 850,000 people don't have power down in Mississippi and Louisiana, and we know that they don't have gas because there are no resupplies. What this project, the Med One Green Project, is doing is taking what we call distributed generation, so solar, wind, hybrid technology, integrating it with a microgrid system that will control how we utilize the energy in our system, and basically putting smart energy to use, providing care for people in crisis.
Should you be in the Gulf area right now, or should you be here?
We should be here because our primary responsibility is to Charlotte, okay. But also because we've reached out to some of our colleagues down in the Gulf area to see what their needs are and whether it's Med One or whether it's using us to help leverage other assets.
I only have a couple of seconds left here, but was there a corresponding effort going on in Tampa medically?
There was a similar medical process that went on to prepare for the convention in Tampa. They don't have a mobile emergency department, so they were more limited to fixed hospitals and traditional EMS response, is my understanding.
And I know that you played a critical role in preparing for the healthcare emergencies and eventualities for this convention. What kinds of things go into that kind of planning?
It started about a year ago, and again, going back to our core mission of providing care for our community and providing care for this event, Carolina's healthcare system partnered with Novant, and it's been a great relationship over the last year working on this particular plan, increasing staffing, looking at the way that we do business on a daily basis and figuring out where are our gaps and how we can improve, and then also partnering with our first responder agents like Charlotte Fire and EMS.
So do you hope that next week you'll be busy or that you'll be sitting there, wherever it is that you're sitting, idle?
I hope we'll be idle, but we're ready if we're not.
Dr. David Calloway, MD, is the medical director of Med One, the Carolinas Healthcare System's mobile emergency department. If you get sick or have a problem next week during the convention and you happen to be downtown somewhere, they'll be there to help you. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gary McCoy, Amazing Carolina Homes, offering home buyers and sellers sales strategies with experience, technology, and market research. A Keller Williams realtor, details at amazingcarolinahomes.com. Well, the moment we've all been waiting for is now. At least it will be next week. The Democratic National Convention officially kicks off on Tuesday at Time Warner Cable Arena. Events surrounding the convention begin Sunday with protest marches downtown. Labor Day, of course, is devoted to Carolina Fest 2012, big outdoor party to welcome conventioneers, locals, and the media to town. And we're going to look at what happened over the weekend and what's ahead for the DNC and for us when we get together in a special edition of Charlotte Talks Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Each week we offer analysis of national news with a panel of top journalists. Whether you listen for 5 minutes or an hour, you'll come away with a deeper understanding of what's happening in the world. Join us for the Friday News Roundup.
The News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Before the convention starts on Tuesday, Charlotte organizers have decided to throw a party, a kind of get-to-know-you party. It's called Carolina Fest 2012, and organizers see this as a way for delegates, politicians, media folks, and you to mingle. Tracy Russ is the chief marketing officer for the Charlotte in 2012 Convention Host Committee and joins us to fill us in on some of the details. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
Are we ready, host committee?
We're ready. We are ready, and we've got visitors already arriving. We're excited to see them more on the way, and we hope that everyone stays and enjoys this historic event, and certainly Carolina Fest is a great way to do that.
Now, this is the party that was supposed to be held at the Speedway, and somewhere along the line, somebody decided that was not a good idea and moved it here. How will it differ from the original plan?
Well, we are looking forward to hosting it in Uptown Charlotte, which has been, you know, the region's living room for a long time. And on the ground and the programs really will be very much the same as it has been planned. Lots of family-friendly activities, music, food, a real focus on the Legacy Village, where the four legacies that were announced last September will come to life.
You know, I'm not sure people know what that is. I don't know what that is, to be honest
well,
with you.
Well, let me tell you, Mike Collins.
Mayor Fox, who has these legacy projects,
yes.
And I do want you to tell me, and they'll be located, or illustrations of them in various forms,
right,
will be located in this place called Legacy Village, which will be adjacent to the Harvey B. Gantt Center.
Well, you do know a lot about
that's
it.
That's all I know. So tell me about the legacy
project. Last year, Mayor Fox challenged this community to come together and work in four areas to make some progress over the year and for the convention to be a catalyst to make some progress that would last not just through the last balloon drop at the convention, but long beyond. So making some progress on economic inclusion, building healthier lives for our children and families, building a more sustainable community, and engaging our youth in this convention effort to give them the skills that they need that really are job skill building, career skill building. And what you'll see at the Legacy Village are over 70 partners, individuals, organizations that have come together over this year, responded to that challenge, and now they're bringing the work that they've done to the Legacy Village, not just to show what they've done, but for other people to get involved during that day and keep making progress right on through the last minute.
Now, this is perhaps the only event that is not ticketed. Anybody can come. All you have
to do is get down
here. Everybody's invited to
That's
attend.
Right.
Now, the streets downtown will be closed by that time, and with them, the parking decks in the sealed area, the restricted area. How do you suggest that people get here, and if they drive, how should they approach the city, and if they do drive and approach the city, where do they park?
Well, I'll tell you, there are great ways to get into the Uptown area. If you'll go to charlotte in2012.com, there's guidance on getting into the Uptown area using coach and motor pools, bus pools that are set up. But I recommend that we all make use of this great investment in our light rail and transit system that's been set up and literally will drop you blocks away from where Carolina Fest is taking place.
And it's taking place where? Up and down Tryon Street?
Up and down Tryon Street. That's right.
And it kicks off at 10 o'clock Monday with a Labor Day parade.
Sure. The Labor Day parade, it starts at 10, and we're excited about that. We think it's going to be a great event. The official program for Carolina Fest begins at 11 with the opening, and then throughout the day we've got some great acts on two stages.
Who's coming? I know that Jeff Bridges is coming.
Jeff Bridges and the Biters are coming.
I didn't know that really he was a real singer, but okay, he's coming. And he's coming.
Yeah, he's a multi-talented guy.
Okay,
he really is. Film star, and now his band's gone very well. Janelle Monáe is going to be here with us, and of course James Taylor will take the stage.
This is extraordinary. James Taylor is giving a free concert on the streets.
Absolutely, you know, North Carolina, James Taylor. It doesn't really get more, you know, Carolina Fest than that, and
wow.
We want everybody to come out and enjoy that.
And all the museums are open free.
The museums are open. Once again, Charlotte showing that the cultural side of our community is inclusive and welcoming. The museums will be open. Great, fantastic exhibits that are going on, some of them tied to the convention.
Right.
Some of them coincidentally opening, but all fantastic.
I find it interesting that it's the only day of the convention that all of the museums are open. The rest of the time, they are closed. Because
it depends,
I guess,
on the museum and on the venue.
I read in the paper this morning they're all closed beginning Tuesday, and I think it's because they're all hosting parties.
They are. They're hosting parties for various events.
But you want folks to come down here. The parade kicks off at 10, and it goes until it's over, and then Tryon Street opens up, and there's food. It's kind of like Spring Fest or Speed
Street. If you've been to an Uptown Charlotte festival, you're going to get all of the, you know, Spring Fest, Taste of Charlotte, Speed Street, all those various aspects of those, and then this great tinge and addition of the Legacy Village that really brings to life that this community is not just about entertainment. It's about getting things done, moving the community forward, and responding to challenges and opportunities.
Tracy Russ, thanks for being here. I hope people show up. I think they will. It should be a great opportunity to have some fun and meet some delegates and meet some and hear James Taylor for coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Come on out.
Charlotte Fest, Carolina Fest 2012, Monday at 10, Uptown. The first political convention in America was held in 1831. The Anti-Mason Party gathered, and despite their name, chose a Mason as their candidate. And the rest is history. And that is what we're going to look at in this segment, the history of political conventions, the role they've played in American politics and government, and their function today. The Charlotte Observer's Jim Morrill has just returned from Tampa, where he covered the Republican National Convention for the paper. And hot off the plane, he joins us now. What was it like in Tampa, aside from hot and humid?
Well, hot and humid was the main thing, but you know, delegates were excited. I mean, they had a lot of, you know, they heard a lot of speeches. Obviously, there were very few unscripted moments. I think one of them came last night with Clint Eastwood, which I wasn't there for. But,
wasn't that a remarkable moment? I was going to ask you yesterday when I was thinking about what I was going to ask you. In the history of conventions, what's the most memorable moment? This has got to be now the most memorable moment. Seriously.
It's one of the most memorable moments, only because in the last few conventions, there have been very few non-scripted moments.
Yeah.
You know, in the last 40 years, everything's been according to
script. Why do you suppose it was non-scripted? This is a very dangerous thing. These conventions have become absolutely scripted, locked-down, controlled events. Why would you do that in prime time? They had this wonderful Mitt Romney video, heartwarming, here's the guy you should vote for video that played just before prime time. And then Marco Rubio, just before prime time, with a great speech. But they go to prime time, and 5 minutes into it, there's Clint Eastwood ad-libbing.
Yeah, I think you'd have to talk to the people that program that, because it seemed pretty out of sequence. You know, in previous conventions when they've had movies, remember Bill Clinton in 1992, they had The Man from Hope, A Place Called Hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was an emotional introduction that led to a crescendo of his speech. With George Bush, W. Bush, they did the same thing. But here there was a separation between the movie, the emotional moments, and the speech by the nominee. So I don't know why they stuck him in there like that.
Well, let's move on to the history of political conventions. You've covered politics for most of your 30 years at the paper. What do you think has been the biggest change in the conventions over the course of time that you've been covering them?
Well, over the course of time, they've become even, like we said, more scripted. I mean, you know, and this one is no exception. The Democratic Convention is no exception. The Republican Convention might have had that little burp, but it was generally along the same lines. The people who organize these things don't want surprises anymore. You know, in 1996, was it, you had Pat Buchanan talking about leading a pitchfork brigade, and people don't want to be surprised. You know, these conventions are choreographed more and more, and I think that's been the biggest change. to amplify the message of the candidate.
But don't people watching want drama? Don't they want to be surprised? Don't they want to have something that they didn't anticipate happen so that I got to watch tonight because who knows what will happen?
Well, you know, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. I mean, that's why there's not that much broadcast of conventions anymore.
Exactly right.
Network TV, there's only 1 hour of prime time.
I know. I don't understand it. I don't understand why you would want to take away all the drama and the reason to watch.
Well, because they're, well,
because you want to get your candidate out there. You want to get people fired up about your political ideas. Show us those political ideas.
But you don't want conflict.
Action.
When we were younger, Mike, and we saw the old conventions, there was conflict. I mean,
yeah.
There was conflict in the 64 convention, Republican convention. There was certainly conflict in 1968,
right,
which is sort of a watershed convention, Democratic convention. And 1968 is a big reason we see the conventions that we're seeing today.
Well, 68, and wasn't it 76, there was conflict in the Republican convention in the hall because it was between Gerald Ford, who had never been elected to the presidency, or the vice presidency, but he was the incumbent,
right?
And Ronald Reagan. And Ford went on to take that nomination in the convention but lose to Jimmy Carter. Was the wrangling in that convention that off-putting to viewers and voters that they never wanted to have a repeat of that again?
I don't think it was off-putting to the viewers, no. But, you know, I think that the parties want to minimize that. You know, we've seen the whole conventions have changed, but so has the method of electing presidents. And, you know, and primaries have become more and more important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the 68 convention, which gave birth to the McGovern Commission, which gave birth to new rules for the Democratic Party, which were largely followed by the Republican Party, you saw more and more states going to primaries. And so elections and nominations are generally settled now early on.
The balloting process, at least for me, I'll ask you about this too, was the most fun back in the day when they actually took votes from the floor and you didn't know which state was going to put who over the top or if anybody would be put over the top and they'd have to do it all over again. That was interesting.
Well, that was drama.
Yes.
I mean, that was really drama because you didn't know how many people were – how many ballots it was going to take. You know, we've had conventions in the past in American history. I think the record was in 1924 where it took 103 ballots to select a nominee.
John W. Davis.
Exactly.
For the Democrats, who went on to lose to Calvin Coolidge. But it wasn't because he had 103 ballots, was it?
I think there were probably other reasons. But that showed that the party wasn't afraid to, you know, sort of expose its dirty laundry there.
Not even Abraham Lincoln was the Republican Party's first choice or even their second choice at their convention in Chicago in 1860. James Garfield in 1880 wasn't the party's first choice. In fact, James Garfield, nominated someone else.
He did. He was a reluctant candidate. I mean, you talk about the 1880 Republican Convention produced two accidental presidents, actually. You had Garfield, who, like you said, nominated somebody else, and the convention only came around to him after, like, 34 ballots or 36 ballots. And so he ended up with Chester Arthur as his running mate, who was a sort of a bow to his opponents, the Roscoe Conkling faction back in those days.
And, of course, Arthur became president relatively quickly because James Garfield was shot.
Right. In
1860, the beginnings of the Civil War, just prior to the start of the Civil War, the Democrats held their convention in Charleston. 10 days this thing went on, and they couldn't decide on a nominee.
They had to take a break. They took a couple months off.
57 ballots.
Yeah.
And I think two Democrats came out as nominees, one for the North and one for the South. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Southern Democrats broke away. I think it was John Breckinridge became their nominee. And the other Democrats, the regular Democrats, reconvened in Baltimore. It was the only first and only convention in American history to take place in two cities.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't work it out in Charleston, so they went to Baltimore, and Stephen Douglas got nominated.
What was the purpose of moving it? Was it just because they couldn't get hotel rooms in Charleston for the second go-around?
I wasn't there, Mike, but
were.
I think they just gave up, you know. Yeah. They were getting nothing done. But the interesting thing was in Chicago with Lincoln, because Lincoln wasn't the front runner that year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he played a really steady game and worked his people.
Mm. Were these ballot tussles, these multiple ballots, trying to find a nominee that everybody could vote for, was that the norm or was that the exception to the rule? Did it usually go maybe one or two or three ballots and we knew? Or was it 57 ballots, 100 ballots, 80 ballots before they found the nominee normally?
I think those were exceptions. But I think they always usually went more than one ballot. I mean, I don't think that you had people who had locked it up like they do now.
Did these candidates for president and vice president emerge from the conventions, or had these people normally been campaigning for the office ahead of the convention?
Well, they campaigned in a different way back then. I mean, they campaigned among sort of the party elite, back in 1860, I think. The people who were running as front runners, the candidates who were talked about more than Lincoln, they were popular within the party. I mean, there was no campaigning like we do today, where you go out and you talk to crowds on the street. I mean, there are certain appearances, but nothing like today.
Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College is a frequent guest on this program and a contributor to WFAE's political blog, The Party Line, says that any modern convention that makes news is often seen as a failed convention. Did the Republican convention make news other than Clint Eastwood?
Well, that's what people were talking about this morning, but I think they tried not to make news. Yeah. The whole point of the Republican convention was to make Mitt Romney an acceptable, more acceptable candidate.
Some other rough spots in American political convention history. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt bolted when the convention nominated William Howard Taft. Wasn't Taft rumored to be his candidate, Roosevelt's candidate, the first go-round?
Well, they had been friends back when Taft got elected, but then there was a falling out, and it became pretty bitter, and that led to a Democratic candidate winning.
And the Bull Moose Party rising for a moment in time. Teddy Roosevelt became the most successful independent candidate in history, came in second. In 1948, the Democratic National Convention adopted a platform plank proposed by Northern liberals, led by Hubert Humphrey, calling for civil rights. 35 Southerners walked out, only to form the state's right Democratic Party, or the Dixiecrats.
Led by Strom Thurmond.
Yeah. Those kinds of things couldn't happen today, wouldn't happen today?
I don't think so. You know, I think the Republicans in Tampa put out a fire such as it was with some Tea Party folks, and Ron Paul supporters who held their own rally on Sunday. But they were able to work out a compromise and solve some of those issues, and I think everybody came on board.
I found it interesting that Franklin Roosevelt became the first nominee to address the convention after he was nominated by the convention in 1932 in Chicago. Why? Why hadn't nominees gone to the podium and spoken to the convention after they'd been nominated?
You know, people campaigned differently back in those days. It is surprising that Roosevelt was the first, but people, their idea of a campaign was like, I think Garfield ran the front porch campaign. He literally stayed on his front porch and greeted people who came to visit him back in those days, and for a long time it was unusual for candidates to go out and about.
Now, the Republicans held their convention this week. Democrats are following here in Charlotte next week. How long has it been tradition that the incumbent party goes second? Is that a rule someplace?
I think it's an unwritten rule. I mean, it's been the case as long as I can remember. You know, they just get to decide theirs, and then the other.
So was last year a coin toss because we had no incumbent running?
Well, who went first last time?
I don't remember.
Well, the Democrats went first, so I think it's a party in control goes last generally.
Okay. Well, Jim Morrill, we'll look for history being made here in Charlotte. Do you think there will be any history being made here in Charlotte?
Well, I think anytime you get, a president accepting nomination to a second term, that's history.
Okay. Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer, thanks for joining us. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the ABEO Group, a consulting firm that manages major change initiatives from concept to completion in whole or in part. Online at wemanagechange.com. Well, it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. The Republican National Convention wrapped up in Tampa, Florida. A federal court found evidence of discrimination in new Texas voting maps drawn by the state's Republican-controlled legislature. Consumer spending and personal income both rose in July, and astronaut Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, died in Cincinnati, Ohio. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about in the first hour, the international hour, at 11 o'clock. And we're going to talk about the Democratic National Convention, which opens here on Tuesday when we come back.
Over 80 golfers will play in the 10th anniversary Greater Hickory Classic at Rock Barn, presented by Kia Motors. This Champions Tour event stops at Rock Barn Golf and Spa in Conover, October 8th through 14th. Ticket information is at GreaterHickoryClassic.com. WFAE is pleased to be a community partner.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This time next week, all the hoopla will be over. The Democratic National Convention will have sounded their final gavel. Do they still sound gavels anymore? And all of this will be part of Charlotte history. But today, it's all still ahead of us. Preparations have been going on for months. Hotel rooms have been booked. The national media is already here. Tents for the major networks have been set up next to Time Warner Cable Arena. The city has announced street closures. Security checkpoints are in place. Caterers have been booked. We're ready. At least we're as ready as any city can be for the unknown. So in this segment, we look at who's coming, who's not, from delegates to candidates to media people to protesters. We look at what we've done to accommodate all these people and whether or not we should really consider this a big deal. Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Eric Heberling, is with us, and he will be with us every day next week during our program to fill us in on the goings-on at the Democratic National Convention. Welcome.
Morning, Mike.
The Republican convention before, you're a political scientist. What happened last night?
Mitt Romney had a challenge in the polls that he's well behind in the favorability ratings compared to Barack Obama. The economy is working in Romney's favor, yet he's still tied at best. So their task last night was to make Mitt Romney a more appealing personal figure to the American public. So you saw very much an emphasis on making us feel more warm and fuzzy about Mitt.
Mm-hmm. He came in very much like a president would for the State of the Union, through the crowd, shaking hands.
Well, he did, and that was very purposeful to show his ease at dealing with people. It was a very populist move. Mm-hmm. I think the visual of that kind of contradicted the attempt to do it. He seemed to be pretty stiff. People weren't seemed to be expecting him. You know, there weren't hugs. It was, you know, kind of bland handshaking.
Can we judge? Is it too early to judge the success of the convention in Tampa in terms in all ways? Success for Tampa, success for the Republicans, success for Mitt Romney.
Yeah, it was a success in that they didn't make mistakes. And as you said in the earlier segment, that's kind of the measure of things. Now, we typically look for a convention bounce in the polls. Typically, they're about 5 points on average historically. I think if they get 5 points, that'll be fantastic because there wasn't a whole lot that happened at the convention that would move the needle either positively or negatively.
A lot of the people, pundits last night on television, were taken aback by Clint Eastwood and at first didn't know what to say or how to react, and I kind of felt for them because what do you say about that, except for the fact that it was riveting.
It was riveting, and I'm sure for the Republican establishment today, they're very unhappy because we're all talking about Clint Eastwood rather than what a great job Mitt Romney did.
We know that many office seekers at the local and state level stayed away from the GOP convention, perhaps not as many who will be staying away from the Democratic convention next week because people have said it's more important to be in their home districts. But who is coming here next week?
You'll see office holders from all levels of the party, members of Congress, senators, governors, mayors, city council members. It really runs the gamut in terms of elected representatives in a party.
And why would you stay away from your own party's convention? Don't you run the risk of either seeming disconnected or unsupportive of your party?
I think if you're in a competitive race, your time is much better spent back home meeting with the voters who will actually determine whether your career continues.
So who is not coming?
Some of the Senate candidates, John Tester from Montana, Claire McCaskill from Missouri, those type Democrats who are in very competitive districts, and there are House candidates who are in the same situation. You know, for them, they don't need the chance as much to network with other party poobahs or with the interest groups. Their time really is better spent back home talking to voters.
When you look at these conventions on the wide shots on television, there are these thousands of people on the convention floor and in the ranks above the convention floor. So not all of them are delegates. Some of them are family members and party members who are not delegates to the convention. So in Time Warner, I don't know how many people Time Warner seats, to be honest with you, but it's going to be thousands of people. 15,000 delegates, I heard, somewhere in that neighborhood.
No, it's
right?
6,000 delegates. Okay, 15,000 media people.
What do they do all day? We only see them on the floor at night. What are they doing all day?
They have lots of delegate meetings. They hear speakers. They spend time going around town.
Well, in these delegate meetings, since everything is decided, what are they meeting about?
Well, they're hearing from speakers, some of the same speakers they'll hear again at night. But it's a chance for many up-and-coming party leaders to go around the various state delegations and essentially audition. The delegates want to hear from people who may be significant figures in their party in the future. And as a candidate who's thinking about making a move on the national stage, this is a great chance to meet lots of delegates who may be delegates in future years.
Are delegates expected to go home from this convention and work for the party, work for the candidate, and are they being trained in some way during these conventions about what to say and how to say it?
Not so much training, but in terms – it's more in terms of energizing them, convincing them that the donation of their continued time, their money is worth it, that this is a cause worth fighting
for. Aren't they
already
won over their delegates? Aren't they already – haven't they already drunk the Kool-Aid?
Turn it up a notch. Call one more friend. Knock on one more door.
How do you get to be a delegate?
In North Carolina, and it varies somewhat by state, but you start off at local precinct meetings of the party. You basically apply. You say, I want to be a delegate. From there, you go on to a county convention. From there to a congressional district convention, up to the state convention. And at each level, you basically campaign. You say, I want to be a delegate, vote for me. Some delegates are selected that way. And then particularly on the Democratic side, there's a number who are allotted at the state level. The Democrats have a requirement that there be balance in terms of race and gender and all the various demographic characteristics. So they use state-level appointments to balance out the delegate ticket.
I've heard, and you've used the figure 15,000 with regard to the media people who will be here. And if you watch TV, you can count on your fingers and toes the number of people probably that work for all the networks combined, maybe, you know, that you actually recognize. But we're talking about what local papers, local TV news stations coming in, local radio stations coming in, and the foreign press.
Absolutely.
In.
Yeah. More than half, I understand, of the press is actually foreign press. So they're coming in here.
Why are they interested in covering political conventions in this country? I understand why they want to cover the race, the outcome of the convention. Why are they here to cover the conventions?
Because this is a signal point in the campaign itself. It's the parties choosing who the nominees will be for the fall campaign. So for the foreign audience who doesn't understand, you know, these eight different candidates who are running in a primary, this is – okay, this is Romney against Obama. Now we understand that context.
What does that say about us? Because it seems to me that we don't even know who the Prime Minister of Canada is, much less who ran against him or her. I don't even know. So why do they follow us so closely?
Because we're the major player on the world stage, both in the economy and in terms of national security. What happens here affects them too.
So what do their readers, their viewers, their listeners want to know about these conventions and about what goes on at these conventions? Do you know?
I think they want to know in some respects the same type of things what a domestic audience knows. But the additional challenge is, particularly for a city, is if we in Charlotte think that it's difficult to get people from New York City or Los Angeles to understand where Charlotte is and what we're about. The challenge is even greater when you're dealing with a foreign audience who knows virtually nothing about Charlotte. So it's a matter of how you connect the obscure or weird questions that journalists from other places might have to local people who might be able to provide the answers to that.
We also know that protesters will be here, or we are assuming that protesters. We you know, we've heard 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 protesters. Tampa, I think there were 300 protesters and only 3 arrests. Is something going on here that we don't know about? That was that all weather related? Was it too hot in Tampa? Are they going to come here?
Probably that the hurricane was the bigger aspect.
So will they come here in greater numbers because they didn't get their day in the sun, so to speak?
Yeah,
in Tampa?
My guess would be yes. That if you didn't get your message out in Tampa, well, now Charlotte's your only chance. We've also found historically that the convention that goes second typically has more protesters. You don't get arrested in the first one, so you can attend and get your message out at the second one. Likewise, as Jim said, the second convention is the incumbent party. So they've had the policies and the personalities that you're there to protest against.
But have they? Well, you know, most of the people who are upset by the economy, and they're upset by the banks, and they're upset by any number of things.
And we have banks. So there's going to be a big protest march on Sunday against Wall Street South. So I think that'll be a big indicator of how many protesters here and how vehement they're going to be.
We talked on this program, as did other radio and television programs, a lot about the GOP platform because some of the planks in it seem to be very controversial. And in fact, one of the platform committee members in the GOP platform called it the most conservative platform in modern history. The abortion plank, the anti-same-sex marriage plank, the plank advocating the elimination of the home mortgage interest deduction. Aside from the plank in the Democratic platform advocating support for same-sex marriage, are there any other parts of their platform that might be considered controversial or as controversial to some as those in the GOP?
As far as I'm aware, everything else is pretty standard. And certainly the media attention will be on that plank, not just because of it's new, but because of the contrast between that plank in the convention and the Amendment 1 vote here in North Carolina that got a lot of national media attention last May.
And much was said about the fact that the party platform for the Republicans was far more severe in terms of its stance than the stance historically taken by their nominee, Mitt Romney. Is there agreement in the Democratic Party with President Obama on many of the planks, or is he also distanced from the platform somewhat?
When you have an incumbent president, they're better able to impose their will on the party platform. The question is how assertive they try to be in doing that. The Democrats traditionally have taken an approach of allowing each faction, each interest group in the party to kind of dictate the elements that they really care about, and you kind of get a smorgasbord of planks in the platform.
How will the Democrats' support for same-sex marriage play in the heartland? Is this going to get a lot of attention as the week goes on? Will it get a lot of attention during the campaign? Will the Republicans be able to use it against Democrats? Will this simply not play in Peoria?
Certainly that's a risk. It's a risk they've obviously considered and think it's worth it. In most states, it doesn't matter, particularly those with strong evangelical communities. They're going to be voting Republican anyway. So the risk for them is really in states like Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that have substantial number of older voters, substantial number of rural voters, where in swing states, you know, losing any fraction of voters is a real risk.
The GOP convention, until last night, actually until Paul Ryan spoke, didn't seem to get very enthusiastic about anything. It was kind of almost like they were on some kind of on Valium or something. Then when Paul Ryan spoke, he got them riled up. And last night there was, you know, it was the balloon drop and all that kind of stuff, and they seemed to get riled up for that. Do you think we'll see something similar at the Democratic convention? Because a lot of people are disillusioned with Barack Obama. A lot of party regulars are disillusioned with Barack Obama. Are we going to see a lackluster convention here?
I don't think so. I mean, you do have complaints about Obama, but I really don't think it's from the core party activists, the type who are going to be showing up at a convention like this. you know, and I think part of the reason that the Republicans weren't riled up is the type of speeches they wrote, particularly during prime time. Mm-hmm. They were aimed at assuaging the public that they're not a bunch of radicals, that you know, that they are family people.
So you're saying that the radicals sitting in the convention weren't enthusiastic about it because it wasn't radical?
Yeah. Well, they weren't getting the red meat that would really rev them up.
The excitement at the Democratic convention in 2008 was palpable, and that is why they moved Barack Obama's acceptance speech to the Denver football stadium. They're doing it again this year, but he's not as exciting as he was in 2008 to many people. Is it a mistake? Would he have been better served speaking at Time Warner Cable?
Or no, I think once you have the event in Denver in the stadium, you have to do it again. You have to at least try to make it bigger and better, because if you don't, then the story is, regardless of what the content of what you say is, oh, they chickened out, they weren't able to do it again. It's an indication of failure or surrender from the beginning.
The other thing that seemed to be coming out from many sources from the Republican convention is that a lot of speakers at the platform were saying things that fact-checkers have proved to be demonstrably untrue, and yet they kept saying them. And one Republican official said, we're not going to be held back by fact-checkers, which is mind-boggling to me. Now, the Democrats are going second. Are they going to spend the week rebutting all those charges, or are they going to just do what they planned to do before they knew what was going to be said at the Republican convention?
I think the one that they really are going to take on is the you didn't build it quote from Obama's speech that really took the core of the Republicans' message and really has resonated among the Republican base. So I think they're going to I think they have to take that on, try to correct that. All the other ones, I think you will see mini corrections show up in people's natural speeches, but they won't necessarily point out that we're correcting Republicans. They'll just be working it into their regular comments.
I got
anyway.
30 seconds left, Eric. What does Obama have to say during his acceptance speech to re-energize his party and make undecided voters take a second look?
That there have been economic improvements, they haven't been as fast or as dramatic as we wanted. We have a plan to do it. We're going to put you in much better economic shape than the plans that the Republicans have.
Dr. Eric Heberlig, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, will be with us every day during our convention coverage next week. This program takes a whole new bent next week, so join us then. Thank you, Eric, very, very much.